revenue, a pay-as-you-go rule would require automatic spending cuts. That could include a $25 billion annual cut to Medicare. Congressman Ron Kind from La Crosse says the timing is terrible.
Got 70 million baby boomers beginning their massive retirement and joining Social Security, Medicare, 10,000 a day. And there's no way we're going to be able to sustain those programs if you pile another $2 trillion worth of debt onto our national credit card.
House Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republican leaders say they would pass legislation to waive the pay-go rule and prevent spending cuts. Around 18% of Wisconsinites currently benefit from Medicare. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
10 past 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Let's check sports and weather. The NBA, the Bucks and Bulls off last night. The Bucks are home against Detroit tonight. The Bulls play the Pacers in Indiana. In the NHL, the Blackhawks will skate in Washington. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday the 6th. Sunny, windy, and cold. Today's high 33. Winds between 10 and 20 miles per hour. Right now it's 27 degrees. Wind from the west at 15. The wind chill 11 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of today's program, we talk dinosaurs with Dr. Thomas Carr. In part two, in a rather drastic shift of focus, we're going to be talking about Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol, as arranged in a wonderful musical by Alan Menken that is currently being performed at the Racine Theatre Guild. You're going to be hearing from the director of the production, Doug Instanis, and from the talented man portraying the role of Ebenezer Scrooge, Bob Benson. But first, part one. Dr. Thomas Carr is director of the paleontology program at Carthage College, currently on sabbatical, actually, but it is not a lazy sabbatical by any stretch of the imagination. We will spend a few minutes talking with Dr. Carr about what he is so ferociously busy with right now, trying to finish up before his sabbatical finishes up. And we're also going to talk with him about a very fascinating course he's going to be teaching in the spring. But primarily, we're talking with him about an exciting and relatively new exhibit that is currently on display, actually at the Kenosha Public Museum, not at the Dinosaur Discovery Museum because it's too large to be housed at the Dinosaur Museum. But it indeed it concerns dinosaurs. It's called Tiny Titans, and we're going to talk about that first and foremost. So, Dr. Thomas Carr, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you here, as always. So let's get assignment number one out of the way and hear from you about this exhibit, quite a large exhibit, and it sounds like quite a fascinating exhibit currently on display at the Kenosha Public Museum. I know you have taken a look at it a couple of different times, and it sounds like you're quite impressed by what it includes.
Yeah, I really encourage the listening audience to head on down to Kenosha Public Museum and take in Tiny Titans. It's a global sweeping survey of dinosaur eggs and babies. It features original fossils and also casts of pretty impressive specimens. Among the original fossils, there's a whole slew of dinosaur eggs, including, at least for me, the most exciting part of it was a very small specimen, so small it could fit on a postage stamp.
Oh, my gosh.
And what the specimen is a patch of embryonic dinosaur skin. And so it's quite cleverly arranged. The specimen is mounted under glass, and it has a video microscope monitor, a camera attached to a screen, so that the specimen's enlarged. And so you can see the scales. And that's what you see first, is you see this patchwork of dinosaur scales. And I think, my thought was, okay, it's some dinosaur skin. And then when I looked at the specimen, I was astonished to see just how tiny it is. You can't even see the scales with the unaided eye.
Huh.
It's just absolutely remarkable that anyone saw it in the first place.
Well, I was just going to say, found it, I mean, at all, or would know that it was anything worth taking a second look at.
Yeah, well, the context is really important. The specimen was found inside an egg, as far as I understand it, of a sauropod dinosaur. So this is one of the long-necked dinosaurs, a titanosaur, they're called, for their immense size. These animals reached upwards of 100 feet, or 30 meters,
wow,
if you understand dinosaurs metrically. and this was one of many remarkable embryonic specimens found inside these eggs. And it's from a locality where there's literally dozens of sauropod nests, not just eggs, but nests. And these specimens were so impressive and important, if I recall correctly, they were published in Science or Nature. So this is really top-flight stuff, a rare opportunity to see specimens like this. And so that one took my breath away. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't prepared for seeing that.
Hmm.
So very impressive indeed.
Yeah. This brings to mind the question of how much we know about this facet of paleontology, about dinosaurs and how they developed. Has this been something that paleontologists either have been deeply interested in and studied extensively, or been in a position to study extensively?
Yeah, the evidence has been mounting ever since the early days, so early 20th century, even before that. In essence, paleontologists are biologists, and so they take a biological view of things, and a big part of biology is reproductive biology. And so the first major dinosaur egg discoveries were made in the 20s in Mongolia by Roy Chapman Andrews under the auspices of the American Museum. And they found dinosaur eggs. They found dinosaur nests. And they, without realizing it, actually found a parent on a nest.
Ah.
An animal called Oviraptor, a meat eater. It was thought that this meat eater was on top of a nest of eggs because it was stealing the eggs to eat. And in actual fact, we found multiple specimens of these Oviraptor theropods. Technically, meat eaters are called theropods or beast feet. Many specimens of parents on nests have been found in China and Mongolia, providing a consistent line of evidence that these are actually brooding parents that were probably keeping their eggs warm during the cool nights in the desert and keeping them in the shaded by their feathers during the day. So for me, the way I view eggs is, and I'm sure others do as well, is that eggs are actually a fossil, if you can stretch the analogy. They're a fossil of the events that happen in the oviduct of a mummy dinosaur. So we have a record, an egg is evidence of fertilization. It's evidence of cell division. It's evidence of the production of what are technically called extra embryonic membranes. Is there evidence of presence of an embryo?
Hmm.
And there are also evidence of the shell that's deposited in a special gland in the oviduct. And so we can identify each of those events, especially the extraembryonic membranes in the shell. We can actually identify where in the family tree of dinosaurs those particular features evolved.
Hmm.
And we can extend that back to this major group of animals called amniotes. Basically, the shelled egg permitted four-limbed animals, tetrapods, to live on land and not be tied to the water, like amphibians, like frogs. You know, they don't have shells on their eggs. They have this gelatinous blob around the developing embryo, and they're tied to the water. But the amniotic egg, which is technically called the watertight egg, was a great leap forward for four-footed animals. It ultimately led to organisms like lizards and snakes, which are technically highly derived lizards. Dinosaurs and ourselves were amniotes too. We are actually quote-unquote reptiles that bear live birth. The most ancient mammals alive today actually lay eggs, so platypus and echidnas lay eggs, and we actually lost this ability that our close amniote relatives still have. So when I view a dinosaur egg, I am imagining what's happening inside the oviduct. It tells us a lot about how mummy dinosaurs functioned. They function a lot like living crocodiles and birds. And we also can learn a lot about how they laid their eggs. We know that some dinosaurs laid their eggs in pairs. And you can see this paired arrangement in some of the nests, the theropod nests that are in the south gallery or the south wing of the display. So we can learn a lot, not only about sort of the mechanics of making an egg, but also how dinosaurs laid their eggs and constructed their nests. So there's a whole welter of information.
Wow. Do you happen to know, I don't remember if you said at the top of your explanation, where this particular exhibit comes from? It sounds like this is a traveling exhibit. It's only at the Kenosha Public Museum through the middle of February.
Yes, it's actually it's the same group that produced the Archaeopteryx exhibit that was at the museum recently. And so it's the same group. I think they're called Silver Plume. And they've had a whole sort of a dream team of expert input involved in constructing the exhibit. And, you know, including people like Mark Norell from the American Museum of Natural History, Jack Horner, formerly of the Museum of the Rockies, Luis Chiappi of the Los Angeles County Museum. So it's really, you know, in terms of the scientific content and educational content, it's top-notch.
So again, this exhibit called Tiny Titans, Dinosaur Eggs and Babies, has just opened at the Kenosha Public Museum, opened in the middle of November, and it is going to be on display there through the 25th of February. And from the sounds of it and from the photographs I've seen, and of course from Dr. Carr's testimony, sounds like a fascinating exhibit that that should not be missed. Again, at the Kenosha Public Museum, one of the three fine museums that are in downtown Kenosha. Our guest for part one of today's morning show, Dr. Thomas Carr, is director of the paleontology program at Carthage College. Dr. Carr, as I walked in and first saw you here in the studio, I cracked some joke about you looking like you've had a nice lazy sabbatical, and as you quickly informed me, it's been anything but. You have been incredibly busy trying to finish up a mammoth project that I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about.
Sure. I'm currently working on a book-length scientific description. It's called a monograph of a subadult Tyrannosaurus rex nicknamed Jane. People can go and see Jane on public display at the Burpee Museum of Natural History in Rockford, just 2 hours away. And in 2009, the task of writing up the specimen fell to me. That's quite a while ago, and it's almost embarrassing to confess. But I'm on the home stretch. The manuscript is basically written, and it's double spaced. It's well over 1,000 pages, 1,137 pages. Last time I looked, and right now I am working on the illustrations, which consists mostly of photographic plates, and so I'm going through the process of the final pass through the manuscript, reading along and making the remaining illustrations as I go. And that's a process that takes hours. And Time's running out.
Yeah. Well, in terms of your own sabbatical, yes. I mean, this is where you have, in a sense, an unbridled opportunity to focus at least most of your time on this huge project. So, in a sense, for whom is a monograph like this created, and essentially for what purpose?
Well, fundamentally, it's for the science, so it's written for scientists. An interesting thing has happened in terms of publication. This will be published by Indiana University Press, and they do publish technical works for not only a scientific audience, but also for a public audience as well. So the very interested members of the public can buy these books, and they have a whole series based on vertebrate paleontology, in particular dinosaurs. There's one called Carnivorous Dinosaurs and Mesozoic Vertebrate Life, and so the list goes on. So this will be part of that series. It's different in that it's not a multi-authored volume with different chapters, focused on different dinosaurs or different aspects of dinosaur biology. This is basically a giant work on how T-Rex grew up. So it's not just Jane. That wouldn't make sense to just write up a skeleton of a dinosaur with no context.
One skeleton.
Yes. Yeah. And so what the way the book is structured is that it's a traditional bone-by-bone description, but I describe the growth series of every bone in the skeleton, and Jane's the centerpiece, so it's the focus. It structures what is described to a large degree. So if I have an animal younger than Jane, I'll describe that bone, then Jane will be step two, and then, step three will be an adult T-Rex. So there's a context, and people can clearly see this extreme transition in growth from the young dinosaurs like Jane and younger animals to the very different adults.
And just to clarify, I think you are using the term young in terms of how long Jane, or how old Jane was in terms of her life on Earth before she died. You're not speaking young as in her place in the scope of history.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Yeah, Jane is a subadult. She's roughly chronologically 11 years old, and so, the adults are in their 20s at least, and we also have younger animals as well. Not all of them are, pardon me, have a chronological age, but we know that they're relatively younger based on overall development. So it's those sorts of features that I really want to draw attention to expand our understanding of how T-Rex grew up in broad strokes. It's actually sort of complementary to the exhibit at the museum.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have on display embryos and hatchlings of various dinosaurs, which is a rare opportunity. And actually, the most exciting specimens in there for me, above and beyond that patch of skin, are the baby dinosaurs.
Mm.
That's where, for me, the rubber hits the road. So there's great research projects, hopefully to come based on that material in the exhibit. But back to the book, yes, so it's a big description and illustrated description of bone by bone how T-Rex grew up. And so it's bringing a whole bunch of data to the table that other dinosaur workers can draw upon to understand the development of the dinosaurs that they might be working on, particularly meat-eating dinosaurs.
How did this opportunity come to you? Is this something that you sought out? Or, did you just decide to do this, in a sense, on your own? Or did the folks who have Jane, who own Jane, so to speak, seek you out? In a sense, who or what generated this project in the first place?
In short, I was sought out. And just to clarify, Jane belongs to all the people of the United States. She was found. We don't know if it was male or female, but Jane was found on federal land, so it means that Jane belongs to everyone.
Hmm.
And the Burpee Museum, like the Dinosaur Discovery Museum, is a federal repository, and so fossils collected by the Burpee Museum on federal lands are reposited there on behalf of the people of the United States.
Fascinating.
So back in 2009, The project was basically offered to me by Mr. Michael Henderson. He was previously the senior author on the Jane Project. Other commitments drew him away from it, but he's still a co-author on it. Actually, all the original authors on that paper are on the project, although I've increased the size of the manuscript by two orders of magnitude.
Mm.
They're still on there. I took the first 1,000 pages for them to see at a meeting a couple of years ago. That's double space, so it's really not that impressive. I say 1,000 pages, but that's the size of it. So I was brought on board simply because I have a track record at that point of publishing on transors, particularly with a focus on their growth. Michael had seen me in action, actually studying Jane, and thought that I really took a lot of care and really wanted to know and understand that specimen. And so based on those aspects, I was given the lead. And the original manuscript was sort of a traditional scientific article, only 30 pages, just this little skimpy thing. And I just thought, we could do so much more with this. And so I just transmuted. I transmuted the project. It'll be a benchmark work. It'll be a much used reference. That's its main purpose, is to be a reference of the anatomy of these animals. And hopefully it'll be great use to paleontologists for generations to come.
Right. And if you are willing to venture a guess, when do you think you will be finished? Do you think that you will be finished before the sabbatical ends and you begin teaching in the spring semester?
That's a deadly question. and I work on it every day. I don't know. I think we're looking at the summer. Realistically,
right.
By the time the summer rolls around, I hope. If not, then the fall.
Mm.
I've just got to cry uncle at this point, because I have a new course that I'm teaching, and I actually have to start getting that into shape.
Sure. And we're going to take our last couple of minutes to talk about that. It's a course titled "The Biology of Alien." And some of our listeners may be able to discern from that title that what we're talking about here actually is the movie Alien, the classic science fiction film directed by Ridley Scott. Mm-hmm. So explain briefly, I'm afraid, what the focus of this course called The Biology of Alien will be.
Well, I'm sure the experience everyone's had watching Alien is the captivation with the alien itself and the derelict ship. And it's, as one person has expressed it, the film sort of captures a complete world. And it's impossible, I think, to view Alien without thinking like a biologist. There's so many captivating aspects to the film. So the crashed alien ship, the underground cavern full of alien eggs, and then the life cycle of Alien. And so it seems to be a natural vehicle for teaching students. In this case, it's an honors course for honors students. It seems to be a very captivating and informative baseline to teach students about some fundamental aspects of biology, cosmology, the scientific method, concepts like the null hypothesis. So it just seems ready-made for training young inquiring minds.
Hmm. And you said that it's going to be quite a collaborative course, and that you're going to be having guest lecturers in on nearly a weekly basis.
Yeah, the basic structure, the way I'm thinking of it now, is students take on a particular question, like, say, the life cycle. So, what can we deduce about the life cycle based on what we actually see? What can we infer? And so I'll have one of our biologists come in and at midweek and give a half-hour lecture on insect life cycles, invertebrate life cycles. And then for the second end of the class, the students would be able to pepper that expert with questions in order to get a better understanding of what they're seeing in the film and what they can deduce from the film.
Hmm.
So it's an odd kind of thing to take a fictional story as sort of a focus of scientific inquiry, but I think it can work. Part of the course is designed to help students identify the limits of knowledge or say where the film violates the laws of physics. I mean, it's all on the table. We don't take everything for granted. But it's an odd sort of thing to treat fiction as if it were a documentary. So it's, and I want students to actually identify where the line is crossed.
Mm. It sounds absolutely fascinating, and even whether or not you are a fan of this amazing film, I could see how this would be a very viable project and quite intriguing, and who knows what it might lead to in terms of similar projects. So again, that's this course being taught in the spring titled The Biology of Alien. Well, Dr. Thomas Carr, it's always fun to have you here, and we look forward to you returning soon.
Sure.
And we hope that all goes well as you near the completion of this 1,000-plus page monograph on the development of T-Rex. And we thank you again for telling us about the Kenosha Public Museum's current exhibit called Tiny Titans, Dinosaur Eggs and Babies, on display there until the end of February. Dr. Thomas Carr, thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you here. It's 8:36, and here's part two of today's program.
Today I don't care if it's gray, if it's Christmas together. People will say we're the luckiest family in town. Mother is making a perfect feast and wearing her loveliest gown. And Father will come and he'll carry me down to Christmas together.
And that wonderful music comes from a musical setting of Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol. And this is, of course, one of the most important stories to be told during the holiday season. And it's being told on the stage of the Racine Theatre Guild in a sparkling production that opened this past weekend and runs for two more weekends on the stage of the Racine Theatre Guild. And I'm really excited to be able to speak with Doug Instanis, who is, of course, the artistic director of the Racine Theatre Guild and also the director of this production. And it's been an exhausting gauntlet, but fortunately, the show opened very successfully this past Friday night and is continuing to be performed, and not only for the general public, but also for area school children as well in some daytime outreach performances. So this is a ferociously busy time for the Racine Theatre Guild and for Doug Instanis. But, Doug, thank you for making time for this conversation.
Good morning.
So tell us about the choice of doing this version of A Christmas Carol. And this is probably as good a time as any to mention the fact that not too long ago, the Guild mounted a different telling of A Christmas Carol.
Right. 10, 11, and 12 years ago, we did the musical Scrooge, and it was a huge hit, and we thought, well, we should bring that back sometime. And then somebody on the play reading committee said, you know, there are other musical versions of A Christmas Carol. We should look at that. And somebody brought this version to the table, and the music is so gorgeous. We said, well, let's not recreate something we did in the past. Let's do something totally different. So that's how Christmas Carol by, you know, music by Alan Menken got chosen, because we didn't want to redo something we did before. This is totally different. And so far, it's paid off. People seem to be really enjoying it.
Hmm. So, of course, lots of people know quite a lot about Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol, that basic story. And I think one of the things that intrigued you, if I remember correctly, is the way in which this musical tells that story and certain themes that really come shining through, perhaps in ways that maybe didn't come out quite as strongly in Scrooge, for instance, or in other versions of it. What do you see as the central themes of A Christmas Carol
that are especially well conveyed in this version?
Well, I think this version is a little bit more religious than in other versions. There's a little bit of talk of God and forgiveness and to God I pray, you know. So, and I think this version, Scrooge, maybe, you know, a little bit more religion, fine religion in this play. And it's not overt. It's not a huge amount. But some of the songs, you know, are a little bit more introverted and asking for forgiveness. And, you know, it's the same story that we all know. Scrooge, a mean old man. And then during the course of his experiences with ghosts, changes and becomes a better human being. And, you know, that's something that we all need to think about at this time period. What's, I think, exciting about this play, which is different than the Scrooge the musical that we did or other musical or other Christmas Carol shows, is that the three ghosts appear early in the play as street people. One is a lamplighter. Another is the sandwich board man, one of those guys that is out promoting theater and with a little sandwich board on him. And then the third ghost is an old blind woman. And they run into Scrooge in the beginning of the show, and then they come back as the ghosts. So, you know, there's always a debate with A Christmas Carol. Do these ghosts really, are they really ghosts? Do they come alive? Do they show him things? Or is this just a dream that goes on in his experiences and his flashbacks through time? So I think this continues that debate when you have three characters that appear early on, and then they come back as ghosts, and then at the end they come back as the street people again. It keeps that debate going, and it's interesting. It's fun seeing them as a lamplighter and then the ghost of Christmas past. So it's fun for the actors to do, and I think it's fun for the audience.
Right. And, of course, in that encounter that Scrooge has with each of them, we have one more opportunity to witness his unkindness, his right. dark, bitter spirit. I mean, he could do kind things to each of these three street people and chooses not to, right. and that's part of what's in a sense, propels the story forward.
Right. Yeah.
One of the things that makes this, I called it a tough gauntlet in terms of getting this show ready to actually perform, is the fact that it is a show replete with at least the opportunity to create some magic on stage, since there are some supernatural elements that are part of the story. Just say a word about that facet of the challenge of this particular show.
Sure. And in a lot of versions of this show, they flew the ghost, but because of our situation, we weren't able to do that. So we do a lot of lighting effects. We use fog. We use snow. You know, there's a big thing in there about the kids seeing it's snowing. A lot of different lighting effects that we've used to try to create that magic so we don't have to fly people. And I think it's working out pretty well. People use their imaginations and you know, the kids go crazy when it snows on stage. That's always fun.
Hmm. One of the hallmarks of any production of A Christmas Carol is going to be who you get to do the central role of Scrooge. Explain what some of the challenges are of this part, and particularly the challenges of this part in this particular musical.
Well, in The Christmas Carol, the musical, there's a lot more singing. And it's not talk singing. In the first show that we did, Scrooge, he could just bark his way through the songs and yell at people and be a gruff old man. In this, particularly in the graveyard scene, he has this beautiful song that just has to rock. And and it's hard. It's hard music. You know, Alan Menken, who did Beauty and the Beast and other great shows, he writes beautiful music for singers. So in this production, you have to do both. You have to be a really good actor, and you have to be a really good singer, because most of the story is told in song. This is very different, again, from Scrooge, which had a few songs. This has mostly songs with a little bit of dialogue. Hmm. So you really need a trained singer that can, you know, he can sell those moments of passion and heartfelt emotion, and then also be gruff and bark his way through a couple other songs.
So, in the role of Scrooge?
Bob Benson is playing the role of Scrooge. And when we did this 10 years ago, he played Bob Cratchit. So he is, there are a few people in the cast that have come back after 10 years. Ellie Hammond is Mrs. Cratchit again. And then we have Mark Geisler and Karen McGee, who are in the ensemble. So four of the cast members decided to come back after a 10-year hiatus and try something a little different.
Hmm. I know that one of the things that has been fun about this production, and certainly true of other productions as well, is the mixture that you have of your sort of old guard. I'm using the term old guardedly here, but veterans who've been in many, many productions here at the Theater Guild, but a cast leavened with newcomers who've never been in anything here before.
Yeah, and a third part of that is also young people that are now have grown up and take on bigger roles that used to be in the kids' choir. For example, Zoe and Jenna, who are lovely young ladies now. They're not punky little fun kids anymore. And so they now get to we get to see them grow as people. And it's always fun to see the new people come. It's like, where were you? Where have you been? And there's a number of new people that have never been in a Theater Guild show before. And then there's some people that have tried out quite a bit. And it's always fun to see them in different roles, too. So we're very excited. We got a great cast. And one of the things that I'm so grateful for is that these people also have to give up time from work. We do 12 daytime performances for school kids. Now, the kids love to get out of school, but the adults, especially around the holidays, maybe don't want to take their vacation time to do shows for us. And we have been very blessed to have an outstanding crew and cast that are willing to take time off from work to do the show for the kids.
Hmm. So how many kids are going to be seeing this in these outreach performances? Have you done the math?
I think there's 4,000-ish. I have to go back and look, you know, what they reserve and what they show up with are kind of different things. But it's you know, 3,500, 4,000 kids.
Wow, yeah. That's extraordinary. And speaking of kids, we should probably mention the fact that there's quite a sizable contingent of children in this cast as well, not quite as large as the children's chorus of Joseph, but just about that large, and sure. And they are making an impressive contribution.
Well, absolutely, they're in a lot and have a lot to do. So we have a cast of 38, and I'm not really sure how many of those are kids, but I would say a good third of them or more are kids, and they work really hard. They've put in a lot of time and a lot of late hours. And, you know, what people don't realize is those parents have made a big commitment. And so we're very grateful that we have a lot of parents that are very supportive of their kids and are willing to drop them off and hang out for 4 hours and come and pick them back up again.
Let's close by having you tell our listeners about maybe two or three of your favorite moments from this show. And I'm thinking especially maybe of favorite songs that you think are especially memorable or especially meaningful?
Well, what I like, there's two songs that come to mind. One is Christmas Today, Tomorrow, in the Future, where they sing. It talks about that there's two types of families, the ones that we choose and the ones that we're born into.
Right. And, I don't remember those words exactly, but yeah.
Friendship from chosen and by birth, I think, is and that's really what sums up the people in the life of the theater. You know, we have a family here of a bunch of strangers that come from different families. So you've got your chosen family and you've got your family that, you know, you were born into. And I think those, when everybody in town is singing that song, it just makes you feel really good. And of course, I think my favorite is the funeral, the graveyard scene where everybody comes out and, Logan sings a nice little solo. We have a kid that sings a solo, and Scrooge is praying for forgiveness, and then the cast comes out and sings around When the World Finds Peace and Happiness and Love, and you know, all those all those nice feelings that you want, and the whole cast is just standing there and in pretty lights singing about love and friendship and forgiveness, and then Scrooge makes his transformation. So I think those two moments really stand out for me as a little different than the normal Christmas Carol moments. And, you know, there are a lot of great moments in the normal Christmas Carol, but in our show, those are the two moments that I like a lot.
Mm-hmm. So A Christmas Carol by Alan Menken and Lynn Ahrens is going to be performed two more weekends for the public at the Theater Guild. It opened this past weekend, and there are all these daytime school performances as well. And if people are interested in getting tickets for any of these remaining performances, what do they do?
Then call the box office at 262-633-4218. Or you can order tickets online at RacineTheaterGuild.org website. Stop by the box office. Plenty of ways that we can take your money. So give us a call. I hope people come see it. It plays through December 17th. Some performances are sold very well, and there's some like some Sunday night performances that we could use a few bodies at.
Hmm. Doug Instanis is the director of this production of A Christmas Carol. Best wishes to you and the cast.
Thank you.
I don't need a fortune hidden in a shoe. Many men have fortunes, but they don't have you. When I look at you, I'm richer than a king. Yes, you mean more to me than anything.
Up you go, son.
Bye, my loves.
We shall buy some apples.
Mum will love them so. Father, look, the theatre.
When we're rich, we'll go. All the joys of Christmas bundled up with string.
But you mean more to me.
You mean more, yes, you mean more to me than anything.
And now we're going to speak for just a couple of minutes with the aforementioned Bob Benson, who a decade ago was Bob Cratchit, and in this version of A Christmas Carol has shifted to the central role of Scrooge. Bob Benson, thank you for taking a couple of minutes out of your pre-performance prep to talk about this experience. First of all, what do you remember most about 10 years ago when you portrayed Bob Cratchit in the musical called Scrooge?
I think my fondest memories, aside from doing the show itself with my son Connor, was the relationship and rapport I developed with Gary Stamm, who played Scrooge at that time.
Mm.
He is a brilliant actor, and I learned so much from him. He was one of my mentors when I first came to the Guild. I guess that was my first outreach show that season, was the first year of Scrooge. So I learned so much from Gary, and it just, I feel like he's part of this production as well. on our last dress rehearsal, we were going through costumes, and the ladies had found my original hat that I wore for Bob Cratchit.
Oh.
So I actually ended up putting that on and had planned to wear it. And at the last dress rehearsal, Peter Jones, who plays Bob Cratchit in this production, was wearing a hat that just seemed out of character for him. It was too nice. It was, you know, too big, too larger than life for Bob Cratchit. He looked at mine and he says, "Well, your hat's worse off than mine. It's a little more tattered." So he took his hat off and we realized it was Gary's hat.
Oh.
So we had a ceremonial changing of the hats. I gave him the hat that I wore as Bob Cratchit, and he handed me the hat that Gary wore as Scrooge. So it was a wonderful, special, and I'm tearing up just thinking about it.
No, that's cool.
It was a beautiful moment.
That's great. How strange is it to be shifting gears from such a lovable character like Bob Cratchit to somebody so thoroughly unlikable, at least for most of the way?
Right.
I mean, how strange is that to be, in a sense, telling the same story, but from such a different vantage point?
It really is a whole different dimension to the story from how I see it. You know, it was such a beautiful, endearing story 10 years ago when I played Bob Cratchit. It's still a beautiful story, but it takes on a whole new meaning approaching it from the eyes of Scrooge.
Mm. What do you see as the most important strengths of this telling of it? That is, in terms of how this score, and maybe also the way the story unfolds, how is this telling of it different? I don't mean now from your own personal vantage point, but in terms of the work itself, how is this show different from Scrooge?
Sure. First, like you mentioned, the score is completely different. This score is beautiful. It really has some gorgeous moments in it. So I think that the music itself is just so far removed from that of the Scrooge production. A different thing about this version that I love is that it delves into Scrooge's past a little more. You get a sense of what happened to him as a youngster and as a young adult that forged his attitude as an older adult. So I think that's, you got glimpses of that in the Scrooge that we did 10 years ago, but I think this really explores that a little bit more. You get a better sense of who he is and why he is that way.
Right, that he wasn't bitter from the moment he emerged from the womb, but
exactly.
But life, in a sense, made him bitter or created at least a lot of that bitterness out of circumstances. What are a couple of your favorite moments from the score? I'm thinking especially musically.
Sure. There's a song called Christmas Together that it happens with the Ghost of Christmas Present, where he is showing how the different families are celebrating Christmas and how some of them are families by birth, some of them are families by friendships, and his point is, this is the most important thing in life, that you have these relationships around you. And then after that scene happens, there's a moment with the Cratchits where Scrooge gets a real sense of how important family is, in that the Cratchits have nothing. I mean, they have a measly dinner that they cobbled together, but they don't care. They have each other, and it's... I think the song is... what do they say about being the richest family in town?
Yeah.
And clearly that's not the case monetarily, but they don't care. It doesn't matter. They have the love for each other, and they have that family unit that makes it so beautiful.
They're rich in all the ways that really count. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bob Benson is Scrooge in this production of A Christmas Carol, which runs for the next 2 weekends. Bob, thank you. Congrats on a wonderful performance.
Thanks so much, Greg.
If you would like ticket information for the Racine Theater Guild's production of A Christmas Carol, you can go to their website, which is racinetheater.org. That's theater spelled T-H-E-A-T-R-E, racinetheater.org. Or you can call them at 633-4218, area code 262-633-4218. A Christmas Carol with music of Alan Menken runs now through the 17th of December. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on the morning show, I'm going to be speaking with Nisha Zenoff, the author of a book called The Unspeakable Loss, How Do You Live After a Child Dies? This is a sorrow that Nisha Zenoff herself has experienced in her own life with the tragic death of her son. But she draws not only upon her own experience and expertise as a therapist, but also draws upon the shared experiences of all kinds of other parents who have lost a child. And the book is a very, very remarkable examination of this very special kind of loss. And we will follow up on the theme on Friday, speaking with a representative of an organization called Compassionate Friends that exists specifically to offer help and encouragement and various resources to parents who have suffered this kind of loss. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We remind you that the